Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, offering crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the May 31 edition of Commodity Week. Well, this week, a Chinese company purchased an American company. We'll find out what that might mean for the livestock, and we'll hear all about how May 31st is passed and planting of soybeans is now officially late.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll talk with AFBF, that's American Farm Bureau Federation, lobbyist Mary Kay Thatcher. Our panelists today include Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities from Newmarket, Indiana, and Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at ADM.com/FarmerView.
Well, let's start our discussion with this question. Kurt Kimmel, May 31st is here and will be soon gone, and that means soybeans planted June 1st and after will be considered late in sowing by the trade. What difference will it make next week?
Well, it'll put more key on the forecast, definitely. If we get another round of moisture next Wednesday, Thursday, like the forecast shows, it's going to put a little bit more heat on the market, put a little bit more risk premium in it, but producer's point of view, quite a few of the beans are in through the Midwest through here. Some guys are lucky enough to have 50% in, but there's still more to go. And ideas are, as long as we get in by June 20th, we're still in position to have a decent bean crop, hopefully.
Wayne Nelson?
Well, you know, Todd, the insurance company says it's June 15th. Up until that point, it's not late planting. You get full guarantee as far as your insurance goes. So we're going to say that basically we're going to be looking real hard to see if the weather's going to let us get to that 95 to 98% planted somewhere between now and the 15th of June. We are going to be watching the weather very closely, but gosh, we've already watched real close and we've really rallied.
And Mike Zuzolo.
I think the ratio between the November beans and December corn would suggest if no beans want to keep leading this rally next week, Todd, the Dease corn will follow willingly. I think this past week showed us that, and I think you're right to point out that emergence being 16% behind the five-year average is a big number, especially as we get into the middle part of June.
Well, Wayne, you suggested that we've rallied quite a bit, and if you listened or watched or read what Darrell Good had to say earlier in the week, his suggestion was that that was the case, too, and at that point, we'd rallied about 75% or 75 cents in the soybeans. Is there a reason to believe soybeans will move any lower from here?
Any lower from here? That's, a hard one to say. I think that there's a lot of other advisory services out there saying that these rallies are something to be taken advantage of. And two or three of the well-known guys have been chunking in 5% every sort of break, you know, like the at the 570 in the corn and at the $13 again, they pitched some more corn and beans for new crop.
By the way, soybeans this week in the November contract had a high of $13.14¾, a low at $12.49½. And it rallied 56.5 cents on the week from its close last Friday. What should producers consider doing with soybeans? Anything at this time?
Well, I think you just stick to the plan. We've been promoting all winter long, all spring long, and have a price floor on you. At this point in time, this close above $13. If we stay above 13, the technical guys are looking to move on up to 13.5. I think you could probably do some scale-up selling and take advantage of this price rally because this weather would change or momentum change, it'd be right for them to taunt a spring high for a little while.
And Mike Zuzalo, your advice?
Yeah, I think the scale-up selling mindset works this year because it's a supply-led rally right now at this point, Todd, even for the beans. You know, we did see China cancel this week, and I think the logistics in Brazil would point to the idea that the higher the price goes now, the more the likelihood the Chinese will cancel more and replace if they possibly can. I think the other thing we watched is very closely is that July NOV bean spread. We saw that spread rally very sharply in 2004, similar to what we're seeing right now. In 2004, though, it was us that had the big stocks. Brazil had the very tight stocks. This year, it's the other way around. So we do have big supplies down in South America. I just can't shake. So I do like selling into that 1320, 1330 level and scale up on paper.
Kurt, let's take a look at some of the numbers as they came from the corn pit this week. The December contract had a high on the week after it rallied 30 and three quarters from Friday to Friday at $5.73. Not very far, actually, just a quarter of a cent, I think, off its high a couple of months ago. And the low was at $5.41.5. The settlement price there at $5.67.25. How does it look on the charts to you?
Pretty good reversal off that low. We're up against some resistance there. If you look at the chart, at 570 areas, significant resistance. If we can pop through it, they're talking to move on up to the $6 to $6.10 level. Technically, you take most of the grain markets, corn and beans in general, the green light is on as far as breaking down trend lines, going to move above moving averages. The trend is potentially moving higher and through here, so that's why we're seeing the commodity funds starting to whet their appetite for grains again, especially if we can pop above that 570 in the D's.
Yeah, when you look at that, there is that little gap there. It's about halfway up. I suppose it's a halfway gap, not an exhaustion gap, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, a lot of the gap or down move occurred right after the March 31st Planting Intentions report and that stocks report. So we're back to some levels here that warrant maybe a few catch-up sales or some additional downside protections if we can't poke through these highs there on the chart.
Dwayne, how far along producers in your area, are they feeling good about their corn crop at this time?
Our corn crop is mostly all up. You know, we've got to be 99% planted. It ranges anywhere from 3 to 8 inches high, and it's looking great. It's one of the most even stands I've seen in the last 10 years.
A couple of things that we need to talk about, and I want to take them up with you, Wayne, because they deal with crop insurance and some farm programs. I'm not sure who will want to answer the acre portion of this, but acre is something that producers can take if they'd like. Gary Schnitke says that's cheap insurance, and it would pay out maybe in a year like this 1 out of 4 years or 25% of the time. So we can talk about that one. And then for you directly, Wayne, we do need to talk about crop insurance across the Corn Belt as it relates to the prevent plant dates. Some of them are today, May 31st. Some of them are June the 5th. And we saw some really big numbers coming out of the Minnesota area, where they were having prevent plant meetings, 200 at a meeting, 500 at a meeting, 1,000 over a couple of days in terms of farmers and landowners. What are your feelings about prevent plant and whether producers should consider it or not?
Well, first off, Todd, number one, to be available for prevent plant, you have to have planted that many acres. Being we're talking of corn first in the past 4 years, like just say that you're at a 3,000-acre farmer, and the most corn you've planted in the last few years is 2,000 acres, you can only take prevent plant on corn on the first 2,000. Number one, then it's 60%, and you can't put another crop out there unless you wait till after the late planting date for beans if you'd put another crop out then, which is gets you into July, and you wouldn't be able to plant another crop. There are a lot of people in some areas when they are so far behind, but remember, you get 100% of the guarantee if you can get it planted before the late plant date, and we only go down 1% each day past that. So say you go to 5 days past the late planting date, you'd still have 95% of your dollar guarantee on a revenue policy.
This is on your revenue policy. So if you were at 75 or 85 or higher even if a percent, you only take a percent off, so you'd be down at 80% then.
Yeah, and I mean, so that's something you want to look at. Is that going to do you better, and are you going to have a chance if the weather turns out good? Basically, you know, if you take preventive plant, you're stuck at 60%. If you have a good crop, we can still make 100, 110% of what that revenue is, especially if we do have a short crop come fall.
Mike, I know you've talked to producers across a good portion of the Midwest. Are they feeling like they want not to plant corn at this time?
Well, I think they are at that point. I think the problem is that they put down chemicals in the spring. They're really forced to stick with the program and stay with the corn, and they're going to probably try and give it another 5 to 10 more days is what they're telling me. Now, you go down to the Missouri Boot Hill, you get into the Memphis, Tennessee, and you get south of that area, and they're already out of the corn and talking about not getting their beans planted. So I think you do have that issue now where knowing that the corn emergence at 54% puts half the states 10% or more behind the five-year average, I'm starting to feel like 1993, June becomes really, really important because it's not just about planting, it's about the emergence. And if we have a wet June like we had in 1993, not only do you lose harvested acres, but then you lose yield big time. We went from 122 in May of 93 by USDA down to 103 by December of 93. So I think this is where your emergence comes into play and what kind of weather we have from June on. And this all ties into that June crop report. Do end users already assess a lower supply? And then if they see a wet June continuing, do they have to come off the end user sideline and come in and start really buying hard because they see a really big drop? I mean, we're talking about drops in yield that compared to the drought of last year because it's too wet like it was in 1993.
Just as a reminder to those who don't recall just exactly what 1993 was, that's the year of the Great Flood. It was called not a 100-year event, but a 500-year event. So it'll be interesting to watch this year as it unfolds and see how wet it remains.
Yeah, we're looking, you know, anywhere from 2 to 3 million acres. That last 10% is the question, but 2 to 3 million acres lost in corn right now. The trade's still looking at a decent yield. You got 2 billion bushel carryout. You're down to 1.5 all of a sudden. But as been said, you lower the yield, and Mike hinted on harvested acres is really going to cut into the old supply-demand balance sheet. Not only planted, but we've got a lot of area we're talking replant where there's quite a bit of pondage taking place.
Okay, Mike, I heard of 1.5 billion. Were you down as low as 1.3 billion on carryout per potential? Is that right? I don't recall where you were.
No, I was right around between 1.5 and 1.6 on the May report. Yeah.
So there have been lots of questions then. Is current price high enough? And I'm wondering what you think the answer is to that for December corn, given that we have half that much as a carryout for old crop.
It's a great question. I think the big key for me, Todd, is I've always felt like you can get December corn to touch $6 at least one more time before we go into harvest. I still feel that way. I would think that we could go well above $6 if the weather stays wet in June, and then all of a sudden we come in with a wheat harvest that disappoints. I think, again, like I said at the top of the show, this is supply-driven, and we're 214 million bushels behind on accumulated shipments versus the USDA projections for exports with 3 months left to go. So they can keep pulling old crop supplies up and taking the ending stocks higher to offset some of the new crops. So I don't want to lose that in all the supply bullishness that we're talking about here.
Okay, Wayne, give me some perspective as it relates to our current conditions in old crop and what we have for new crop. Currently, we have, a carryout projection of about 752.54. I don't quite recall what that number is, but in that range. And July is at $6.62 on the board. And let's use the projection of $1.5 billion for carryout. In December corn is at 567.25. What are your thoughts?
Well, Todd, we know that old crop corn is tight. We know that we're going to have pretty good demand from the ethanol plants, but it seems like they cap out around that $7 mark. You know, we're down here at the $3.60 to $3.90 type gasoline prices. We're going to see the bulk of the summer driving is starting to begin now after Memorial Day. So we're going to have the ethanol plants in there as long as they can buy supply on the old crop. New crop, I'm looking at big supplies out of South America, out of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay. I'm looking at, if you looked at the last Russian statistics, a lot of wheat, a lot more corn, And I think we're way optimistic on our next year's projections for usage.
All right. Now, let's turn our attention to livestock very quickly. In the hog market, I'm wondering what the chatter in the industry is, and we'll start with you, Mike, maybe, as to the potential purchase of Smithfield Foods by a Chinese company and what it will mean to pork supplies in the United States and availability in the coming years.
I don't think we'll have a tighter supply in the United States in the coming years, Todd. The first reaction I have is the Chinese were able to produce five times more pork than the United States, and they ran out of room, and now they have to go searching for the production because their people are eating a record high, 86 pounds of it a year in terms of pork for consumption, with really no signs of slowing down.
Well, we'll hope that just helps balance some of the payments between China and the U.S. with this deal.
I think this is probably one of the most bullish things that's happened in agriculture. I think if you read the headlines a year or two from now, it's going to be the great pork robbery of 2013. China's food security policy, I think, has come forward here. They're bringing home the bacon to their country and leaving pork rinds home here in the U.S.
That's Kirk Kimmel with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Wayne Nelson is with us from L&M and Mike Zuzulo from Global Commodity Analytics. We'll talk with Mary Kay Thatcher from the American Farm Bureau Federation when we return.
This is Jim Angel, state climatologist located at the Illinois State Water Survey. We had another wet week for much of the state. The heaviest rainfall totals appeared between Interstate 72 and 80. 3 to 5 inches were common, and a few areas reported 6 or more inches. Tolone, which is in Stark County, reported the most rainfall with 7.8 inches for the week. Right now, May temperatures are within a degree of average. At the time of this recording, it was still raining across the state, so we don't have the preliminary numbers for May yet. However, as of Friday morning, west central Illinois, basically south of Interstate 80 and west of Interstate 55, had monthly totals in the range of 6 to 12 inches. Areas in southern Illinois had amounts in 4 to 8 inches. The only areas to escape the heaviest rainfalls were in far northern Illinois, north of Interstate 80, and far southern Illinois. Both of those areas had 3 to 5 inches of rain, which is much closer to normal. According to the National Weather Service, a cold front will push through the state on Saturday. As it moves through, it will trigger rain and thunderstorms ahead of it. However, by Sunday, cooler, drier air will arrive and remain through at least Wednesday. During this time, daytime highs will be in the 70s and nighttime lows will be in the 50s and even down into the 40s in northern Illinois. Skies are expected to be mostly cloudy during this time. This is Jim Angel, state climatologist at the Illinois State Water Survey.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at ADM.com/FarmerView.
You're listening to the May 31 edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Our panelists in studio include Kurt Kimmel and Wayne Nelson. On the phone line, Mike Zuzulo. And on the other phone line, our guest is Mary Kay Thatcher, the Senior Director of Congressional Relations at the American Farm Bureau Federation. Mary Kay, thank you so much. I invited you on for a particular reason, because earlier in the week I watched a C-SPAN video of Illinois Senator Durbin, a Democrat, talking on the floor about means testing for crop insurance above the $750,000 income level. What's AFBF's current view?
Well, we were very opposed to that, as was, I think, every other farm group and many of the conservation groups. We just feel like crop insurance is very different than farm programs. We don't support payment limits on anything, but, you know, this is a program where farmers do have skin in the game.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, our real concern about it is that it sets a very bad precedent for the future. If it's $750,000 today, we could have an amendment on the Senate floor next week to further lower that. We could have amendments on the House floor. So it's the real nose under the tent.
Well, we know how you feel. How do most of our legislators that are going to vote on it feel?
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Durbin did win his amendment by a vote of 59 to 33. That was slightly better than we did last year because we had 66 people who supported it. But I think, you know, part of the big issue was that we did tie it to conservation compliance with crop insurance. And I think had we not had a vote on exactly the same amendment, we might have prevailed. But members of Congress don't like to change their vote from year to year. Then they go out to campaign and people say, well, you flip flop on issues. We will have, however, the same fight in the House and probably a worse one in the House. So we need to be prepared.
Mary, what's the odds of even changing the whole name Farm Bill in general? It seems you got the farm name up there, and they're trying to tie rich farmers to that. And Food Stamp, for example, they changed their name to Supplemental Nutrition Assistant Program. Now, how can you knock that down at all? Seems to me if you would call it the Food Aid Bill in general, you'd have a little bit more success or have less alligators nipping your rear end, I guess.
Well, I think that's true, you know, and we haven't really had the word farm in the Farm Bill now for several years, nor is it in either of these versions, but it's been called the Farm Bill since the 30s, and so it's hard to get people to change. We were successful when we got the change from calling it estate taxes to now to the point we have most people calling it death taxes, but we haven't quite accomplished the idea that it's something other than a Farm Bill. But I think you're right. The perception would be good because a lot of folks don't understand that 80% of the money in the Farm Bill is for nutrition programs and only 20% for programs that have some helpfulness to farmers.
Can you tell me about the differences in the SNAP program between the House and the Senate versions and what battle that might encompass as they try to bring those two together?
You know, that's going to probably be the biggest sticking point. We only have about $4 billion in cuts in the Senate side. We have $20 billion in the House. Doesn't seem like very much, but will seem even more insignificant when I remind you that the pool of money of which they're cutting is $770 billion in food stamps primarily and nutrition programs over the next 10 years. So very trivial, but it's a real philosophical issue. You generally have a lot of Tea Party Republicans who feel like they want to take way more than $20 billion in cuts. And generally speaking, you have a lot of liberal Democrats who think you can't take any money at all out of food stamps. So it is not near as easy as you and I might think to just come up with a number between 4 and 20 and say, here it is, and go home. This will be a big debate. And I suspect on the House floor, if we cannot get a farm bill passed, it'll be because we can't come to an agreement on food stamps.
What is AFBF's view on what impact the lower of those two numbers might have?
On the lower number on food stamp cuts?
On SNAP, yeah. What would happen?
Well, I don't know that much would happen. I mean, you are going to get some people who are going to get pushed off the program. But generally speaking, what you're looking at in those amendments are closing loopholes. There is a provision called low-income heating assistance program whereby they were trying to make it easier so a person didn't have to go fill in the same forms to qualify for different kinds of assistance throughout. And so they said, well, if you get as little as $5 check in low-income heat assistance program from a state, you qualify for food stamps automatically. So we have states who took advantage of that and do indeed send a very small check to people in order to qualify them for free food stamps. I mean, I think what we would say is if they qualify, that's great, but just because you send them a brochure or a $5 check doesn't mean that they automatically meet the requirements necessary as far as poverty, et cetera, for food stamps.
Let's switch gears back to farms directly. Can we talk a little bit about the World Trade Organization and whether either of the bills, either the Senate or the House, would have ramifications in the WTO if they were passed?
Well, I think that's really hard to say. You know, for the past few farm bills, we have talked a lot about farm policy and making sure that we meet WTO requirements. And not saying that we were going to develop a farm bill that would meet the requirements when we reduce those trade-distorting supports, but at least keeping an eye towards thinking about that. We have about $19 billion limit on what we can do in what's called trade-distorting supports, things like money for marketing loans or target prices or the acre program, et cetera. And if the WTO round was to move forward, that $19 billion is scheduled to fall to about $7 billion. So it would be a big difference. I think this year it's very different in that while people don't want to run afoul of the WTO, they also look at it and say, you know, the Doha round is dead. Let's not even worry about it. You have trouble scraping up a handful of members of Congress and senators who care about the WTO and making this farm bill fit amongst it. So it's a very interesting scenario in that for the first time in a long time, you're not really talking about trade in response to this farm bill, other than people looking at the Brazil cotton case and saying, okay, are we coming around with that project and getting it done?
Mary Kay, it sounds like sort of an uphill, hopeless battle for farmers to keep them from gutting the insurance program. Is there anything that our listeners, the farmers out there, can be doing that would even do it, would even help?
Well, I think they need to reiterate that crop insurance is the most important risk management tool they have. And to be honest, I don't think farmers have been particularly engaged in the farm bill over the last year or so. I don't know whether it's because prices have generally been good or, you know, we've had weather issues, but we need to get reengaged because we have lots of members of Congress say, I'm just not hearing from my farmers and ranchers about what's important to them. And I think one of the real fallacies out there is, you know, when people say, well, agriculture is good, it's doing much better than the general economy, what they overlook is the fact that we may be doing better now, but we all know the high prices we have now for many commodities won't continue forever. And we do write a farm bill for bad times rather than good. So this is a five-year plan. We need to have that safety net in place. And farmers are the ones that have to get in touch with their members of Congress and remind them of this.
That was my question. What can a producer do out here in Rural Route 3 to have their voice heard? It's the simplest thing you suggest for them to do that.
It's as simple as picking up the phone and making a call or shooting an email. You know, I don't really recommend snail mail anymore because it gets x-rayed so much and takes weeks to get there instead of a couple of days. But you'd be surprised at how few people really call about agricultural issues and therefore how much impact just a few calls can have.
Does it make a difference if they also call an urban congressman?
Well, most congressmen really only want to talk to people in their district. And, you know, it makes sense. You want to focus on the people who can actually vote for you, and the people who vote for you want to make sure you're watching out for you versus somebody from another district. So most people who aren't from your district in the House aren't going to be interested in talking, and if they're not from your state in the Senate, they're not going to be interested in talking. You know, you may get a receptionist that will listen, but most likely that's about as far as it'll go.
And finally, could you take up estate taxes, because that's come back up on the Hill, at least in the president's budget?
It has. I mean, you know, I think we all breathed a big sigh of relief on the 1st of January when we passed the bill that extended the estate taxes. $1 million would have been a pretty low limit. But it's not like we won that battle forever. Any Congress can overturn what a previous Congress has done, and we still are in a very much tax reform mode. So we're going to have to stay on that, and we're going to have to continue. You talk about what farmers can do. There is so little understanding, especially from those congressional staffers that are young and haven't really been out and worked in the world except working in Capitol Hill, on how much equipment and land and all the different inputs in agriculture really cost. So they need to understand the implications of $1 million limit or a $2 million limit and how that really works. It sounds like big numbers to a 24-year-old who's just out of college but working for a member of Congress.
Mary Kay, thank you so much. Mary Kay Thatcher is with the American Farm Bureau Federation. A very quick final word from our panelist in studio, Wayne Nelson.
We're going to be watching planting progress a lot on Monday along with the weather forecast, and we'll make some decisions then.
Kurt Kimmel?
We're back to levels where we wish we could have, should have been a week and a half ago, and there's a lot of creative ideas to manage risk and challenge you to take a opportunity of those different programs out there.
And Mike Zuzolo.
Well, like last year, Todd, I think we're in that supply-driven rally with a little bit shaky demand, and I think like last year, we want to scale up, sell on rallies using mostly paper positions and try and leave the cash alone as far as the sales until we get through the month of June and kind of play it like last year as far as marketing with the idea that maybe the weather will be like 1993.
That wraps up Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason.